Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
It's another edition of The Media Project, the weekly discussion and analysis of all things media. I'm Mike Spain, the former associate editor at the Times Union, filling in for my longtime boss there, the editor-at-large, Rex Smith. He's away this week. We have a great panel assembled, starting with Dr. Alan Shartok, the chairman and CEO of Northeast Public Radio, from where this program originates in Albany, New York. Welcome, Alan.
And thank you, Michael. It's always wonderful when you step in for Rex. He's great, but so are you.
Well, thank you. And we also have investigative reporter extraordinaire and journalism educator Rosemary Armeo. Good to see you, Rosemary.
Thank you, Mike. Good to see you, too.
And rounding out our panel is Judy Patrick, a veteran newspaper editor in New York's Capital Region, where she led the Daily Gazette in Schenectady for many years and now is the vice president of editorial development for the New York Press Association. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you, Mike. Nice to see you as well.
Thank you. Lots of news to talk about, but of course, number one on the list is the challenges covering the coronavirus. News organizations have to walk a fine line in covering this topic. They need to convey the story's seriousness without provoking panic and help make sense of what the flood of news is all about, even though we still don't know a lot about it. At the same time, we have to remind people to be safe and to keep their employees safe, too. And we're talking about the news media. People covering it have to be careful that they don't come down with COVID-19. What are the biggest challenges, Alan?
Well, I think that the biggest challenge is that we don't have any answers. We really are beset with probably the greatest problem that I can remember in a long time. We are faced with this potential of a major pandemic in this country. We're being told by everybody, I read every story I can find on this, don't touch your face, make sure to wash your hands. Well, we really don't know, of course, and this gets to the media part of this. What we really don't know, and nobody can really tell us, is whether this virus resides in great numbers in this country that we don't even know about. And in fact, we're just sending out the kits that will help us determine that. Other countries test thousands of people. We're in the hundreds up until now, and that is extraordinarily dangerous. So the papers have to carry the news, but what are they going to carry?
Right. Well, Judy, you've edited a local newspaper for many years. How can you report this without sensationalizing it while underscoring the importance of it?
That is something I've really been torn about because a lot of the cable news channels, I feel like they're feeding the panic. But then again, if you watch Fox News, they're downplaying it so much that people aren't taking it seriously. One of the things the mainstream media does a good job of, and I think they're doing a good job this time, is laying out the facts and putting it in perspective to some extent. I don't want to get back to that. Remember the time when we're all buying duct tape and plastic sheeting. I can't even remember what panic that was for. But this idea that, you know, everybody's buying the masks and the Purell sanitizer, that seems crazy. But in some respects, you do see people saying, don't do that. They're trying to temper it. So I think mainstream media is doing a good job, but it's social media where things are going crazy.
Yeah, how do you control that? It's really impossible to put a lid on social media. Although they're trying to do that in China, it's just impossible to do it here. It's a very different country.
Well, the way they do it in China, I was just listening to NPR on this subject, is they, if you say something that they consider to be unwise, they put you in jail.
Well, that's very effective. Do you think there's any issues that we need to be careful about in the media regarding personal privacy? If there was somebody in your neighborhood where, you know, they suspected they had been exposed to the coronavirus, would you want to know about it? And is it right to point that out?
Yeah, I think we worry too much about sensationalizing. There are some stories that are sensational, and this is one of them. It's like O.J. in the white Bronco going across town. That was a sensational story. The media covered it straight, and it was still sensational. I think that's what we have here. Yes, I would want to know if my neighbor had the virus, and there will be some invasion of personal privacy. Sometimes covering news means going into other people's privacy, and a pandemic definitely fits my definition of that. The best story, by the way, that I've read any place so far was in the Washington Post, and it was about touching your face. You're not supposed to touch your face because it spreads the virus, but every human touches their face about 24 times an hour.
And as soon as you read it, you start to get a twitch.
I had to rub your nose and all the things that, yeah.
You know, but I think in New York State, I think the public health system there has done a good job of keeping the public informed. I think Governor Cuomo does a regular briefing with reporters, which in contrast to what's happening at the federal level, I think is much more reassuring to the public.
You know, I think that's another job of the press in this, is to hold the officials accountable, which you just did, complimenting people when it's done right, protecting doctors from the National Institute of Health and CDC, who are under pressure from our federal government, we know from the media, who want a rosy view, a rosier than truthful view coming out, and they're being honest about it. The press protects them, promotes them when they do it well. I think that's an important part of our job.
Now, the question is, are we doing enough as the press to hold, as you just suggested, to hold officials accountable? For example, just let's take what President Trump has done here. He's given to his vice president, a non-doctor, the responsibility of heading this task force. But what does he know? He knows zippo. And what's happening? We're in the midst of an election. One in one makes two. Does the press do a good enough job of analyzing the politics of the situation?
Well, politics is a big part of this story, especially when initially the president tried to downplay the impact of this potential problem. And
he said it was a hoax.
Criticized the media and then did backtrack. Is it right for the media to, if they see the president or the administration spokespeople saying what it contradicts medical science, what contradicts what the experts are saying, is it right for them to give it equal play, or should they point out that it's incorrect? That can tend to politicize it too and make it look like the media is jumping on the president trying to take him down with this virus, which he claims.
Well, they got to worry about that. On the other hand, this is an incredible president, and I mean incredible. He tells lie after lie after lie after lie. So who could believe him about anything? That's why you don't want to lie, because when it really does count, the little boy who yelled wolf, when it really does count, nobody's going to believe you. And that, of course, is going to weaken the position and the credibility of the president, the vice president, and all the people who are with him. You know, it's interesting because from the media perspective, the media has pointed out who the good guys are on the federal level. And when they are trotted out quite frequently by the vice president, there are some contradictions between what the vice president and the president has to say and what the credible people on that team are saying. And the media has done a pretty good job of pointing that out.
Yeah, there's been some real challenge in the industry about how to treat this as a political story or as a medical scientific story. Some criticism of the Sunday morning talk shows last weekend, because a lot of the questions dealt with the politics of the situation and didn't get into the fact that maybe having some health reporters asking some hard questions of Vice President Pence would have been better than having asked pure political questions.
Yeah,
I think it's both, and I'm not sure that we have to make a choice, and the press should be putting a lot of attention on the performance of Pence, who is a possible presidential contender at some time in the future, or quicker if something should happen to the president. And that's not a wish, by the way. Please don't think that. But, you know, you don't necessarily have to be a doctor to be in that position. You need an organizer who can work with doctors. Is Pence doing that? Is he negotiating the problems of a very difficult boss who's made clear what he wants to come out of this, and the doctors who see something different? Is he negotiating the economic impacts? Is he dealing with the medical issues? Pence has simply been seen as an appendage of Trump rather than someone that we're evaluating in his own right.
And one of the issues is, so they haven't been doing a lot of tests. So if you don't do a lot of tests, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of problems. And maybe there's a political reason they haven't been doing a lot of tests. And those are the kind of questions reporters should be asking.
Right.
Well, we'll have a lot more to talk about as the weeks go on. But the other big story this week, of course, is politics and the Democratic primary. And just weeks after pundits all over throughout our media were writing off Joe Biden, the former vice president. He came in fifth in New Hampshire, and then along comes the South Carolina primary, then Super Tuesday. Should journalists have foreseen the rise, the inevitable rise of Joe Biden from the ashes?
I'm not sure it was inevitable, and I think the two stories we've just discussed are connected. People watched Trump up there, and did they feel like they were in the hands of someone who cared and knew about what he was doing? And I think suddenly Joe Biden, and it was very sudden, was the endorsements he got, and then the coronavirus that suddenly made Biden look like a very desirable candidate again. Give me some peace. Let me have someone who knows what they're doing. I want the old comfortable uncle, and I don't care if he doesn't know the difference between his wife and his sister for a minute or two. I can deal with that. I can deal with that.
They stood at each of his sides as he was on the podium, but I think most people realized his wife was on his right.
Yes.
Well, yes, and as long as we're talking about that, let's just not forget that, you know, a couple of people rushed up to the stage, and Jill Biden got a hold
of it. Cross body block a little bit?
a body block. It went viral. There was more about
awesome.
That on the news as I watched it the other night than you could possibly believe.
It's been a lot of good publicity for Joe Biden since South Carolina. According to one advertising firm that monitors it, the media attention Biden received after the primary in South Carolina and before Super Tuesday added up to about $70 million in advertising and monetary value because he got so much media attention.
It's an extraordinary political story, unprecedented that I know of, at least in modern times, that someone has gone from so low to so high. So that attention—
So quickly,
right. So it's warranted, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, it begs the greater question. Is the media doing a good job covering this primary? Is it just a horse race?
Is the media actually perpetuating this new primary system where it begins almost the day after a new
midterm
president is
sure.
Right, and it just continues on and on. And whether or not we needed all the debates and all the discussion of the last 2 years when Bloomberg swoops in at the last minute, starts spending a ton of money. What were all those debates and all that discussion on the talk shows? Was that all just to generate ad revenue for cable news networks?
What do you think? I mean, you're a superb editor now, ex-editor of a major newspaper, and, you know, you had to pick out the stories every day. There's free advertising, and then there's paid advertising.
I can tell you that when in previous rounds of presidential cycles, we did not run stories about early presidential debates on cable news networks because they weren't productive. We didn't feel like they advanced public discussion of the issue as well. And there were too many other real things happening.
But weren't you worried, Judy, Patrick, that, you know, somebody would point their finger at you and say, that front page is boring?
You know what? There's plenty of news every day. There's plenty of things to choose from. And another Republican debate with 17 or 18 people on stage was not interesting enough to put on the front page. Often it wasn't interesting enough to put inside.
Yeah, well, this competitiveness thing is something I think about a lot. I mean, your competitor was the guy who was sitting next to you, Mike Spain, and the Times Union and the...
Gazette and the Times Union are great rivals and continue to be.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for that. But, you know, somebody will eat your lunch if you don't do what the public wants.
Ask Mike if he put it inside or on the front page.
I'll leave that one for Rex next week when he's back in this chair. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to The Media Project, a production of Northeast Public Radio, and we have Dr. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Judy Patrick, and I'm Mike Spain. Now, another story that's making the rounds in the media business is whether journalists should be allowed to vote in primaries and indicate by voting as a Democrat or a Republican in many states. Some let you do it regardless of your party affiliation. You know, are you participating in it and showing your bias? Or should journalists just disassociate themselves from the democratic process? What do you think about that, Rosemary?
I don't think they make enough money to lose their rights as citizens.
Well said, Rosemary. Great.
That's a good answer.
And I have to tell you, I voted. Massachusetts had early voting. I walked in. I was the only one in the room. I voted, and my vote wasn't wasted. Let's put it that way. Because a lot of people voted for people who ended up quitting the race. So you can think about who I voted for. I'm not going to tell you, obviously. That would be wrong. But I did go in, and I couldn't agree with you more, Rosemary. Why would you deprive people who are the closest to it from knowing what was going on? I've always thought that the people who claim that they didn't vote or that they weren't registered were just plain lazy.
You know, I didn't know it was a thing not to vote if you were a journalist. I mean, I never have registered in a political party. I've done that, but I vote. I mean, I'm still a citizen, but there are quite a few journalists who are putting as a badge of honor that they don't vote.
Well, a lot don't affiliate in a particular political party. They don't enroll. When I came to Albany to work at the Knickerbocker News before working at the Times Union, that was more than 40 years ago. You know, we were advised by our colleagues that if you live in the city of Albany, you better enroll as a Democrat, because if you don't, you won't be able to vote in the primary. And that's all that counts in Albany, because really 90% of the people in Albany are enrolled Democrats, and you are disenfranchised. You can't participate in the political process.
And I know a guy who claimed that his taxes went down when he finally registered as a Democrat.
Well, speaking of journalism and the money, and Rosemary brought up the little bit of money they make, the New York Times pays its reporters over $100,000 a year at a starting salary.
Yeah, but they have to live in New York. So
they do.
Let's
they
put
do,
that into some perspective.
Here's a question for you. As the New York Times continues to grow and thrive, I think they have 2 million online subscribers now, and it's sustaining their growth. They're beginning to look like a Pac-Man in the media business, gobbling up all the space in the journalism landscape. As Ben Smith, who is their newly christened media columnist, wrote a provocative column this week asking, is the success at the New York Times bad for journalism? And the idea is that they're gobbling up all the best. A lot of their critics, a lot of the best people in Politico, Gawker, Recode, et cetera, are now at the Times. The Times will go out and hire the best ones. In fact, Ben Smith himself had been the top editor at BuzzFeed before coming to the Times recently. I mean, is the Times' success making it impossible for others to be successful on a local level?
Well, it's inevitable. Even your erstwhile friend Rex Smith has made the claim years ago that in 10 years there would be nothing. There would be no print newspapers. And I think there was an exception for the Times and the Washington Post. You're right about Pac-Man, but that's what's happening, and I think it's inevitable.
Oh, what an elite attitude. We have the best people, and no one compete with us because we're such a great newspaper. They are a very good newspaper. I will give them that. But we're a country of millions and millions of people, and there are lots of talented people out there that can compete with them as well. The fact that they are paying high prices, kudos to them for that. But there are plenty of other journalists out in the landscape that can hold their own with them.
So it gives them a lot of power, doesn't it, Rosemary? I mean, they have a lot of power. So, you know, they can make or break people. Now, who was it that they endorsed for president?
Well, they endorsed
that didn't do anything.
Not that much power.
Listen, we used to learn years ago that you can talk all you want about ethics and best practices, but if you can't sustain a news operation as a business, it's all for nothing. And the New York Times is sustaining business. The fact that Ben Smith is there is proof of that. And the power and the spirit of BuzzFeed now is living in the New York Times. And I think that now they should be turning their attention to local news, not because there's so many wonderful things happening at the local level. I think all the reporting in the New York Times, local and international, is better than at the local level. But that's where it starts. That's the lab. And if that dies, then you have nothing that rises to the level of the New York Times international reporting. And therefore, because it's in such trouble, who will be supporting that? What is the New York Times doing to develop news out of Albany and New York and Schenectady, for example, to support the papers here or to send people here?
Well,
so I think it's a challenge for them, and I'm glad that an entrepreneur like Ben Smith is at the New York Times. That's the next challenge.
I don't want anybody to think that the New York Times does nothing. We have a wonderful friend here at WAMC, Jesse McKinley, who's on with us all the time, who covers New York State.
Oh, and he does a remarkable reporter. Yes, absolutely
job.
Great journalism at the New York Times. No one disagrees.
But when you open up the Times in the middle of the night on your device, you have to go way, way down the list to get to the New York State section. So I think Rosemary makes a point.
Yeah, and the New York Times has always had great power. Let's not forget that if you're a reporter competing from another newspaper or news organization with a New York Times reporter, guess whose call is going to get returned first? Or if there's only one call going to be returned, it's going to be to the New York Times. So the rest of the media is at a disadvantage.
It's the classic question.
The callback rate for the New York Times reporters is higher than anyone else in the business.
Yeah, it's the classic question. A politician comes out of a closed session, and on one side is the NBC reporter and the other side is the New York Times. Where do you go?
Well, Victor Pickard, who's an associate professor of the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Journalism, is arguing for changing the whole model for local journalism and that the for-profit model doesn't work anymore. And I think a lot of newspapers are experiencing that, local news operations. He said radical reforms are needed to help journalism survive. He is suggesting that news operations should switch to being a system that relies on charitable support, and it's not too different than public radio. What do you think of that idea?
Well, but who would, first of all, I don't like it. tell them to keep their hands off our money. You're just kidding, of course. But, you know, it's been tried, and it works in some cases, but you got to remember, these are private operations. People are making money. Now, if they want to give up the idea that they have paid advertising and all the rest of it, fine. Then that's the way to go. But I want to see a not-for-profit board like we have and the rest of it before they do what you're suggesting.
Well, Pickard says most people become journalists for relatively noble reasons, certainly not to become wealthy, and they hope to serve the public and cover stories that will make a difference. But they do have to eat. They have families. I mean, there's got to be some way to sustain this. And except at the New York Times level, the Wall Street Journal level, maybe the Washington Post level with Jeff Bezos, the billionaire, funding it, it's a struggle. And it's going to create a lot of news deserts, which we talk about a lot on this program.
I'm not sure that Americans appreciate the value of local news coverage. They've had it so effortlessly that they do not value it and they do not see it going away. And the price is increased corruption if it's not covered. If you don't look at the travel vouchers of officials, they're going to cheat. They're going to give themselves raises. It happens everywhere. Mm-hmm. We don't know it. So maybe losing some of it and suffering is what it will take. So I don't see a replacement.
I'm sorry to divert the conversation, but do you think there's ever corruption at newspapers?
Of course, and in many places it's covered. Journalism industry has a reputation for eating its own. You commit a crime in a newspaper and you are the subject of front page streets. Just ask Jason, what's his face?
Jason Blair,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Eight pages of investigation into what he had done there.
Yeah, they were forced into that. The New York Times investigating the Jason Blair.
Well, there was also the coverage in California when they did the CIA involvement in drugs. That was a major investigation. Gary Webb ended up dead, killed himself. The organization I worked for, till I came back, was a nonprofit, and they did major pieces on ownership, hidden ownership of newspaper and other media outlets throughout Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And of course, it's all politicians and big businessmen who were buying influence. So I think corruption is rampant.
But newspapers have a tremendous amount of power, news organizations do. So for example, let's say they have what is called in the business an S list, you know, people who, we don't like this guy, so we're not going to cover him. We're not going to give him any publicity. He may be a competitor. He may be something else. That's corrupt, isn't it?
It's kind of bad journalism.
I'd say bad journalism.
I'd say corrupt.
Yeah. Well,
I'd say an aberration.
I'm thinking of
an aberration meaning it doesn't happen.
I don't think that happens.
It happens.
Often.
It happens. I've been up close and personal. I've seen it.
Well, there's been a lot of news this week about John Bolton's new book. It's been delayed again. It was going to come out in mid-March. Now they're saying May. And it's all because of the White House pre-publication security review. You know, the New York Times had reported that the original transcript for the book alleges that President Trump directed Bolton to help him pressure Ukraine to come up with damaging information against Democrats during the primary season. But now, according to the Washington Post, Trump has told staffers that everything he uttered to the departed aide, that would be Bolton, about national security is classified and that he will seek to block the book's publication. And that's according to two people familiar with that conversation in the Washington Post reported. Bolton argues his work, which is titled The Room Where It Happened, is just him telling history. Should the president have the power just to filter out any unfavorable information in a book that's going to come out?
Hell no.
I don't think this book will ever see the light of day, at least not during this administration. But the question is, will John Bolton see his $2 million, and will all those people who put advanced orders on Amazon for it get their money back?
I don't like
any of the people in this little drama. I don't like Trump for what he's doing. And Bolton should have talked to Congress without waiting for his book. I don't want to buy it when it comes out because of that. I don't like any of them. We should boycott coverage of
it. The question is, do you write stories about the book once it comes out and further promote it? Do you have him on your news show?
exactly.
Why do I have the feeling
Joe Donahue interviewed John Bolton.
On the book show.
Why do I have the feeling that somehow, some way, this book is getting out?
Well, it's already listed in the top 100 books for 2020 to date because of pre-orders on Amazon. So we'll wait and see. As we get close to the end of the program, one-fifth of Democrats and Republicans who were surveyed by the Pew Research Center, found that they get their news in kind of a media bubble. 20% of the Democrats and independents who lean Democratic get political news only from outlets that have left-leaning audiences. And the same goes for an equal amount of Republicans and those leaning Republican. They get their political news from outlets that are right-leaning, like
Fox News.
Now, this includes 12,000 people in this study. This kind of media polarization is unhealthy for democracy, but what can you do about it? How can people begin to look at sources that they don't agree with and understand the value of that? Any suggestions?
I don't know. When I watch Fox, and I try to do that every once in a while, I want to throw up, to be honest with you. So I get away from it as fast as possible. We know that people go where their views are confirmed, no matter what, whether it's their friends. I have a friend who won't go out with a guy because she says he's a Trumper. I mean, that's the way life is.
And one of the challenges here is that there are so few right-wing sources. Most people go to Fox. The liberals tend to have MSNBC, CNN, the regular broadcast networks. They have a variety of sources. They have four or five that they go to. And people who support Trump tend to just go to either Breitbart or Fox. It's such a singular voice that that's disconcerting.
But it's why, Judy, of course. Fox is the largest of the cable networks in terms of dedicated watchership.
I like to invent a word every once in a while. In the minute we have left, I just want to ask, was it a surprise that Chris Matthews is out at MSNBC?
Oh, boy. Okay, so I want to defend Chris Matthews. I thought he was obnoxious and interrupted people and didn't like him for the longest time. And then he interviewed Trump in the last election and got him to admit that Trump really thought women who had abortions should be punished. And he did it with that same pushy, obnoxious, in-your-face style, and it worked on Trump. And he does that to everybody. That whole interview with Elizabeth Warren that he's been criticized for as being dismissive, I thought it was the same style he used on Trump, and I liked it. And she handled it well. I also am a little annoyed at women who remark is made to them, and they go write some whiny little essay instead of just putting the guy in his place at the time. I thought his apology and his exit was dramatic and deep felt. At 74, I think he should be retired anyway. I have such mixed feelings about it. I think he's being pushed out because MSNBC wants to bring in the guy at Fox who got fired.
Okay, well, we're out of time.
Thanks
to our panelists on that note, Judy Patrick, Rosemary Arameo, and Alan Chartok, and I'm Mike Spain. Tune in again next week for The Media Project.
Thanks for stepping in, Mike.
Prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling. Advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.